were great and the burden of loss as heavy as can be, but the mourning families maintain that they're proud of their martyrs and are ready to make even greater sacrifices, because to them the protection of their country and its values is far more important than anything or anyone they could ever get. Maryam Azashir, Tehran.
Iran and Russia are holding a joint maritime rescue and relief exercises in the Caspian Sea aimed at boosting naval coordination with neighboring countries. Our correspondent, Gisu Misha Ahmad, has spoken with Drill's spokesperson, Rear Admiral Mohsen Razoghi, at the event's venue.
With the entrance and the arrival of the vessels, we have seen beginning of the KSRX 2025 with the slogan, "All of us for the secure Caspian Sea." All the vessels have arrived in the premises of the drills, the naval force of the Islamic Republic of Iran, and the drills with the attendance of the vessels from the Islamic Republic of Iran's Navy and from the Russian Federation and some participants from neighboring countries in the Caspian Sea. And the Islamic Republic of Iran and the naval force of Russia and the naval force of the Islamic Republic is determined to have security and to maintain security, whether in the Caspian Sea and the Persian Gulf and the Oman Sea, with the participation of regional countries and their cooperation and partnership and the sympathy of these countries.
Iran has successfully conducted a test launch of a suborbital satellite carrier named the Qasid as part of a developing space program. Tests aimed at assessing emerging technologies currently under development in Iran's space industry. Results are expected to enhance performance of domestic satellites and related systems. The Qasid carrier has been developed by the IRGC Aerospace and designed for faster and more accurate deployments. It was first inaugurated back in 2020 when Iran's newer satellite was put into orbit. Rising death toll, ruined homes, and shattered lives. These or Palestinians are enduring in Gaza, where dozens of people have been killed in fresh Israeli attacks since dawn today. Among the new victims, 13 Palestinians who lost their lives in an Israeli artillery attack on tents housing displaced families in Al-Shati refugee camp in Gaza City. Two children also died due to severe malnutrition and lack of essential nutrients. According to Palestinian Red Crescent, nearly 120 wounded Palestinians have been treated now at Al-Quds Hospital in Gaza City since the early hours of this morning. This U.S.-Israeli campaign of genocide, which began in October of 2023, has now killed more than 59,000 Palestinians and left well over 142,000 wounded. And to get a better assessment of the atrocities by the occupation against Palestinians in Gaza throughout the day today, we're going to swing over to our Gaza correspondent in Deir Bala, Moti Abu Musab. Moti, good afternoon, pal. Good to check in with you and seeing that you're doing well. What can you share with us?
Yes, actually, I'm really baffled where to begin from, because every single part of Gaza Strip is still witnessing more cruel attacks of the Israeli occupation forces, claiming more lives of the Palestinian civilians, particularly the Palestinian women and children. And let me begin with the major attack that took place in Al-Shara refugee camp after the Israeli occupation forces targeted a cluster of the makeshift tents of the displaced people there, killing at least 14 Palestinian civilians, many of them were women and children. The dead bodies were found completely charred and, as you know, shredded beyond recognition because they were targeted indiscriminately by the Israeli artillery. This is another horrific massacre unfolded in that area, and it is added to the ongoing and ceaseless Israeli massacres also committed day and night against the Palestinian people. Meanwhile, two other Palestinian dead bodies were extracted from the rubble of the destroyed houses in Jabalia refugee camp. And here in the central area of Gaza, as you know, the current situation is still disastrous, and it is precarious, particularly in Deir Bala city amid the ongoing military offensive, which targets the southern outskirts of Deir Bala city, we are talking about ceaseless and uninterrupted Israeli brutal air strikes and attacks, in addition to the artillery strikes, which are still ongoing and abated, targeting those areas. Those attacks are still ongoing for more than 48 hours without any cessation. At least 25 Palestinian residential buildings were completely destroyed and pummeled by the Israeli warplanes. In addition to that, as you know, the Israeli bolts of fire are still repetitive, targeting the area. Hundreds of thousands of the Palestinian people were forcibly expelled out of those, as you know, shelters that they were taken inside that area. So the current situation is absolutely horrific, and it is very cruel for the Palestinian people in Deir el-Balah city. And till this moment, we are able to hear those deafening bombardments resulted in from the chronic and extensive artillery shelling maintained against that area. Let me remind you that Deir el-Balah city was claimed since the start of this genocidal onslaught till this moment as a safe zone for the Palestinian people. They have demanded, I mean the Israeli occupation forces have demanded the Palestinian people to go to Deir el-Balah city, claiming that it is a safe place. And now they are attacking Deir el-Balah city directly. We are talking about roughly 40% of the entire area of Deir el-Balah city was demanded to be fully evacuated from the Palestinian people. But unfortunately, the people don't have any place to go to amid these prevalent and ubiquitous attacks are still covering everywhere in Gaza Strip. And what is really horrific and excruciating for the Palestinian people is that they are no longer able to move from a place to another place. They are absolutely exhausted, and they are frail from starvation, from dehydration, from the catastrophic humanitarian conditions. They don't have anything to eat. They don't have the transportations. They don't have anything to help them just to endure this, as you know, this unbearable pressure maintained by the Israeli occupation forces. And even when it comes to the southern parts of Gaza Strip, the Israeli attacks against Al-Mawasa area were continued over the last night. Another attack took place there, claiming the lives of three Palestinian civilians after they were targeted by the Israeli occupation forces.
All right. Well, thank you for that comprehensive update, Moti, and stay safe there, pal. Moti Abu Musab joining us from central Gaza. Meanwhile, the United Nations has expressed a deep concern over the breakdown of humanitarian conditions in Gaza, condemning Israel's targeting of starving Palestinians seeking aid in the besieged strip.
The Secretary General is appalled by the accelerating breakdown of humanitarian conditions in Gaza, where the last lifelines keeping people alive are collapsing. He deplores the growing reports of children and adults suffering from malnutrition. The Secretary General strongly condemns the ongoing violence, including the shooting, the killing, and the injuring of people attempting to get food for their families. Civilians must be protected, civilians must be respected, and they must never, ever be targeted.
Dujarric said that civilians must be protected and respected, and added that Israel must allow and facilitate humanitarian relief provided by the UN and other humanitarian organizations. He said Israel's evacuation order in parts of Deir el-Balah has restricted the UN's ability to deliver life-saving aid. And on Monday, the World Health Organization said the Israeli military attacked its staff, residence, and main warehouse in Deir el-Balah. The UN Health Agency warned the evacuation order in the city has affected several WHO premises, compromising agencies' ability to operate there in Gaza. Two more Israeli soldiers have been killed in Gaza, marking yet another setback for regime's military and ongoing confrontations with Palestinian resistance. According to Israeli media, 19-year-old Staff Sergeant Amit Cohen from the Golani Brigade's 13th Battalion was killed in Khan Yunis in southern Gaza. Another incident, an occupation force reservist was killed in Gaza fighting. According to Israeli media, his killing took place after a blast caused a building to collapse. New fatalities come as Palestinian resistance continues to put up fierce resistance against occupying forces, inflicting heavy losses on them. Regime's authorities often conceal the true scale of troop losses in Gaza amid growing criticism of this ongoing campaign of genocide. Estimates suggest around 900 Israeli soldiers have been killed in Gaza since October of 2023. Yemeni armed forces have carried out yet another retaliatory operation against Israel, targeting Ben Gurion Airport with a hypersonic missile.
In support of the oppressed Palestinian people and the resistance fighters, and in response to the crime of genocide perpetrated by the Zionist enemy against our people in the Gaza Strip, the missile force of the Yemeni armed forces carried out a qualitative military operation targeting Ben Gurion Airport in the occupied Yaffa region using a Palestine 2 hypersonic ballistic missile.
Saudi said the operation successfully achieved its goal and halted the airport's operation, adding missile strike force Israeli residents to also have to flee to local shelters there. A spokesman also praised the Yemeni people for supporting oppressed Palestinians amid the Gaza genocide. Saudi underlined Yemen's anti-Israel operations will continue as long as the genocide in Gaza persists and Israel keeps up its blockade on the territory. The latest retaliatory operation was launched following a drone strike by the Israeli military on Yemen's port city of Hodeidah. And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News.
My life has been a journey, where faith is where I roam. What steps I used to walk in don't really match mine no more. I live south for the river, where children are quick to grow. Walking down the street full of distraction, for some they call it home. So take me home. Now my world has much more meaning since you came into my life. Lessons you place in my journey, let me know you shine in your light. Right here is where you found me, so lay my head at night. Surround me with good intentions as I close my eyes tonight. So take me home, I gotta find my home. So take me home, I gotta find my home.
IRIB English Radio in the month of Muharram presents Today's special. Every day for 15 minutes.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful, Salamun Alaikum, and welcome to a new episode of today's special from IRIB English Radio. I invite you to be with us. Today we're going to speak about the guiding light.
Oh, our hearts are full of grief, for our beloved it bleeds. We cannot bear this life unfree. They killed him mercilessly. They kill the living Tawheed. A three-year-old girl was in the arms of her dear uncle. She caused the deserts to flow with endless tears of Abulfath. The endless tears of Abulfath.
On Tuesday, 26th of Muharram, 1447, of the Islamic Lunar Hijri calendar, corresponding to the 31st of Tir, 1404 of the Islamic Solar Hijri calendar, and the 22nd of July, 2025 of the Christian Gregorian calendar. So at first, let's open Allah's book. From the Holy Quran, today, verses 15 to 20 of chapter Al-Fajr.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. فَأَمَّا الْإِنسَانُ إِذَا مَا ابْتَلَاهُ رَبُّهُ فَأَكْرَمَهُ وَنَعَّمَهُ فَيَقُولُ رَبِّي أَكْرَمَنِ.
And as for man, when his Lord tries him and thus is generous to him and favors him, he says, "My Lord has honored me."
وَأَمَّا إِذَا مَبْتَلَاهُ فَقَدَرَ عَلَيْهِ رِزْقَهُ فَيَقُولُ رَبِّي أَهَانًا.
But when he tries him and restricts his provision, he says, "My Lord has humiliated me."
كَلَّا بَلْ لَا تُكْرِمُونَ الْيَتِيمِ.
No, but you do not honor the orphan.
وَلَا تَحَاضُّونَ عَلَىٰ طَعَامِ الْمِسْكِينِ.
And you do not encourage one another to feed the poor.
وَتَأْكُلُونَ التُّرَاثَ أَكْلًا لَمَّا.
And you consume inheritance, devouring it altogether.
وَتُحِبُّونَ الْمَالَ حُبًّا جَمًّا.
And you love wealth with immense love.
لَا إِلَهَ إِلَّا اللَّهُ. لَا إِلَهَ إِلَّا اللَّهُ.
Bless your day with contemplation on the verses of the Holy Quran.
مَا لَنَا رَبٌّ سِوَى.
These verses warn that neither the blessing is the reason for the proximity to Allah, nor is adversity and the lack of blessings the evidence of being far from Him. They are but diverse factors by which Allah, according to His wisdom, examines people. It is the human being who sometimes becomes proud and sometimes hopeless because of his limited capacity to understand and endure.
I learned from Hussein how to be wronged and be a winner. I learned from Hussein how to attain victory while being oppressed.
Hussein, Shaheed.
Hussein, Ya Hussein, Ya Hussein.
Hussein, Al-Gharib, Al-Gharib, Al-Hussein. Hussein, Shaheed, Al-Shaheed, Al-Hussein.
Hussein, Al-Gharib, Al-Gharib.
Our main question for today's special: why is Imam al-Hussein the guiding light and the salvation ship? Studying the lifestyle of Imam al-Hussein, peace be upon him, at all times can be salvation and guidance for us. In fact, knowing the lifestyle of the Prophet is like a ship. And a ship that when we try to live like them and know the boundary between right and wrong and adheres to it, it's as if we have embarked on the salvation ship that we will be saved. So we will live in this world with pride. We will achieve true happiness and peace. And in the hereafter, we will achieve lasting happiness and real life. The most important point in the life of all the infallible imams, including in the life of Imam al-Hussein, is the guidance and call for truth. It is a responsibility that has never been abandoned. And all of our imams adhere to it and rested their lives on it. Those nobles themselves were on the right path, and their main concern was to save the people from superstition and falsehood.
And the mere fact that you and millions upon millions of others just like you have answered the call, the silent call that is made in the heavens with the start of the holy month of Muharram and attended these gatherings of mourning and lamentation, it means that the knock on the door of Hussein has been answered. It means that you are now welcome to board the Ark of Salvation. The Ark of Hussein has now docked right here for all of us to board it. Nobody's forced into their salvation. No one is coerced into boarding the Ark of Hussein, alayhi salam. But the opportunity is presented to all of us. Imam al-Hussein is here to save me and you. Now, let me start with a question that perhaps is not commonly addressed. Year after year, we've been asking ourselves, how is it that the grandeur of the gatherings of mourning of Imam al-Hussein just keeps growing and growing. Year after year, you think that at some point we would reach saturation. At some point we will have enough mosques and centers and gatherings and homes and elsewhere that would be sufficient to provide the required capacity. And yet year after year, it keeps growing and it keeps glowing and it keeps getting bigger and better in every conceivable way.
On the month of Muharram and the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hussein alayhi salam and his family and companions, be with today's special. Every day from IRIB English Radio.
People rise up and mourn, it is Ashura. See the struggle of Hussein in the Kabbalah.
This is today's special, and we are in the month of Muharram, so it's very good position to speak about the effects of the movement of Imam al-Hussein. One of them is freedom. After so many years, one of the quotes of Imam al-Hussein is still remembered. If you do not believe in religion, at least be free in your world. This saying invites the whole world to practice freedom. The message of Imam al-Hussein continues, and his followers reject submission to oppression. Freedom from enslavement by tyrants or anyone except Allah is one of the points of Imam al-Hussein's revolution that can be used to realize the true values of Islam in this day and time. Hence, those who are in love with Hussein, no matter what religion they have, will try to free themselves from misfortune and obedience to anyone except Allah by following Hussein's path. Peace be upon him.
Allahumma ja'al mahyaya mahya Muhammadin wa ala Muhammad wa mamati mamata Muhammadin wa ala Muhammad.
One of the lessons of Karbala can be gisted in this phrase, don't accept humiliation. In one of his speeches, Imam al-Hussein, peace be upon him, said that the authorities in Kufa had given him only two options, humiliation or death. He carried on saying, and we do not accept humiliation. A tradition reported by Imam Sadiq, peace be upon him, records that other than not accepting humiliation, Almighty Allah has given to believers a choice in all matters.
The love of Aba Abdullah al-Hussein is part of our fitrah. It is not part of our tabi'ah. There is a hadith in which Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam says, Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. He says that Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam, Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. He says when Imam Hussein was a young boy, he one day took him and placed him on his lap. And then he talked to the people about his grandson. And he said, Inna liqatlil Hussein حرارة في قلوب المؤمنين لا تبرد أبدا. In the hearts of the believers, there is a burning passion for Hussein that will never cool. Never, never. That is why you speak to a man who is even 70, 80 years old. He has heard the masaib of Abu Abdullah year after year after year, but every year it is fresh. Because it is a blood that does not dry. A man asked the sixth Imam alayhi salam once, he said, Yabna Rasulullah, didn't your Jad, the Messenger of Allah, say, Mathalu Ahlul Bayti ka mathali safinatun Nuh. My Ahlul Bayt are like the Ark of Nuh. Whoever comes on board will be saved, and whoever turns away will drown. He said, yes, my grandfather indeed said that. He said, then why did your grandfather also say, Inna al-Husayn misbahul huda wa safinatun najat? That Hussein is a lamp of guidance and an ark of salvation. Why specifically Hussein is an ark of salvation when the whole Ahlul Bayt is like the ark of Noah? And Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam said, Kulluna sufunun najat. All of us are arks of salvation. وَلَكِنَّا سَفِينَةَ الْحُسَيْنِ أَوْسَعَ وَأَسْرَعَ. But the ark of Hussein is wider, more spacious, and it moves faster. What does it mean? It means that if you fall in love with Hussein, his compassion is so much for humanity. You merely have to look at Hussein, he will lift you and take you on board his ark. Come to Hussein, he will show you the path to fitrah. He will show you the path to salvation.
Interesting discussion, interesting topic to speak about. And inshallah, we'll continue there. Thank you for listening and fi amanillah.
عليك مني سلام الله أبدا ما بقيت وبقي الليل والنهار ولا جعله الله آخر العهد مني لزيارتكم.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
There are journalists who excel at presenting intricate global affairs with clarity, offering fresh perspectives on the stories that shape our world. Their investigative work often challenges dominant narratives, opening doors to deeper understanding. My guest today is one such individual who has dedicated her career to uncovering the truth behind complex international issues, producing thought-provoking and influential reports that resonate with audiences worldwide. Welcome to SORP. I am Bahman Roy, your host.
Anya Parampil is an American journalist known for her work with RT America and The Gray Zone. She has gained recognition for her investigative reporting and coverage of international affairs. Her journalism often focuses on geopolitical issues and has brought her into the spotlight for interviews and collaborations with prominent figures.
Ms. Anya Parampil, it's so good to have you on SORP.
Thank you for having me. It's wonderful to be in Tehran and to explore this country.
Lovely to hear that. Anya, if I may call you that since the beginning of the interview and to make sure, give us some insight into your upbringing, something that inspired you to go after such a career in journalism.
I think part of what gave me the perspective I had is growing up in a home that was very American but also international. My father was born in Kuwait but is from India. Was educated in India until he came to the U.S. for university and met my mother. And they started a family and chased the American dream. But my dad, because he had this international perspective, was always talking about news in an international way, just really from the perspective of the domestic media. Uh-huh. And so that kind of challenged me to always think about the whole world and chase sources that weren't just only based in the United States, and to just have an interest in the world at large, because I would hear him talking with his friends about different historic figures or global leaders, and I wanted to keep up with the conversation. And so that eventually just led to an interest in wanting to consume media. And then once I did that, it just kind of pushed me in the direction of working in media. And my mom, she always questioned things, had a different view of the world, not just again what we were told in the mainstream U.S. media. She was studying to be a teacher of English as a second language, and was talking about Noam Chomsky because he's a linguist, but also a great political thinker. And so, between the two of them, I was exposed to a lot of different ways or alternative ways of thinking. But at the same time, I think that's part of a tradition in America that I would like to see grow, of people not just focused on the inside, but trying to learn about the outside as well.
Of course, thinking out of the box, I can see that you were raised in a culture of critical thinking, and that is very impressive from the things that you just told me. And where did you decide on continuing your education regarding this field?
Well, originally I actually wanted to be a diplomat. So I after high school, enrolled at the George Washington University in D.C., at the Elliott School, which is right across, it's their international affairs diplomatic school that's right across the street from the State
Impressive.
Department. You can see the State Department on your way to class every day. And on one hand, I was so excited to be in D.C., and there were a lot of interesting people there. On the other hand, I did see that there were a lot of students my age who weren't trying to go in there to change things the way that I wanted to, but they actually just believed in the status quo and believed in the system. And on a whim, I sent a resume to RT America, the branch of the Russian International Russian Station that was based in Washington at the time, and got an internship. Ended up quitting my studies to work there full time and anchor, and I had a great few years there until things changed, but that's the nature of media, and now I've been able to enjoy an independent career. But I would say I got my education in terms of broadcast journalism and presenting at RT rather than a traditional classroom, because I left that behind.
Yeah, and I was just curious to know, any of your classmates at the university, did any of them ended up in the government?
I don't know.
Figures that I might know.
I got out of there pretty quickly. I think they're still quite young. They wouldn't be very recognizable or prominent now, but I'll keep an eye out.
Of course, and you got your education, like you said, in the field, which makes a lot of difference, of course. But did you have a chance to go and work for RT in Moscow?
I did not, unfortunately. I have never been to Russia. And my name, Anya, which is Russian, is really just a coincidence, because my Indian father and American mom couldn't agree on a name. So they picked that, they heard it. But then I ended up working for a Russian station with a Russian name. But no, I've never been to Russia, and I would love to, but it hasn't happened yet.
So your interest in Russian foreign affairs, it came from working for RT America?
Well, my interest in U.S.-Russia relations... Yeah. Yes, definitely came from that, and getting the inside of working in the office, though the vast majority of the people who worked there were American like me, and many of them were hostile to the way we presented things, and they were definitely allowed to be voicing their opinions and be critical of the coverage. You know, the Syrian war was happening at that time. There were many Americans who didn't agree with me. I it's not that I took the Russian line. I was against U.S. intervention as an American, so I was comfortable opposing it and comfortable criticizing the U.S. role in that conflict. And what we see now, we were people on my side of the debate, I think, were proven right, now that we see Al-Qaeda in charge of the country and running a genocide against minorities and maybe even normalizing with Israel. But that was what my concern was then. That's just an example of how I think my views fit with where I ended up, though there's always this drama in the United States over Russian media, and eventually the U.S. government pretty much put enough pressure on RT to shut it down.
Right. And any public figure within the realm of presenting, hosting, who could be like an inspirational figure to you?
Well, I really liked Glenn Greenwald, the print journalist, growing up. It's funny, I don't agree with everything or his perspective, but I really enjoy watching the Fareed Zakaria show. I think he was also a good voice during the time of initial U.S.-Iran negotiations back in the Obama years. He was always defending Iran in the context of the U.S., where, you know, everybody is talking about an extreme vision of Iran that I think he helped break through. And he has a good way of accessing international figures and presenting international news, even though I think now he's kind of just fallen into the liberal establishment. But I would say he and the people that I worked with at RT were some of the people that I admired most.
Lovely. And of course, you were working with RT before, naturally, before it got shot down, from working in the US and also Europe. Any challenges you were facing as an anchor, as a news presenter, while working there?
The greatest challenges came from the pressure that the US government eventually exerted on the channel. They forced in, what was it, 2017 or 2018, they forced RT to register as a foreign agent. Not something they did with Al Jazeera, not something they did with BBC, not something they do with the Israel lobby in the United States. So they were taking a media outlet and forcing it to register as if it was a foreign lobbying group. And this had implications for us because then we could no longer access U.S. government figures. Many guests were afraid to come speak to us because then they have to report back to the U.S. government that they spoke with us. But it eventually turned into a situation where the head of the network in the United States gave in to the pressure and kind of wanted us to cool off from our traditional way of doing things, which is why I ended up at the network to begin with. And that was the point that I ended. It became a conflict when they wanted to exert more control, but not for me to say things that were pro-Russian, for me to just silence myself in terms of how I criticized U.S. policy because they were afraid of the U.S. government.
Yeah, and it started from when exactly? I want to make sure, what government was in charge at the time?
Well, it was under Trump, but it wasn't because of Trump's people in the administration. It was during this period when the first round of Trump, when they were trying to say that Trump himself was a Russian agent. Do you remember there was this Russiagate fiasco?
Yeah.
And so the way that they went about it was to say that RT had somehow helped Trump get elected. And the U.S. government actually even released this Office of International Intelligence released a report trying to prove Russian interference in the U.S. election. And the vast majority of the report was criticizing RT's coverage, saying that we had covered Occupy Wall Street, that we had talked about third parties in the United States, or that we had criticized Wall Street. These were all things in the U.S. government report that were trying to blame Russia for Trump's victory or prove that Russians had somehow changed the outcome of the election, when in reality we were doing the job that any American journalist should have been doing but weren't permitted to do. And so in the end, it was a wild scene, but it was really a part of the administration that was opposed to Trump, working within the Justice Department, that wanted to target us.
So, and of course, your journey with RT America ended that way. And where did it take you from? What was your next step?
Well, it was the end of 2018, and I happened to be in a unique position where my husband, Max Blumenthal, he had an independent outlet, The Gray Zone, and another friend of ours, another colleague, Aaron Mate, he also lost his job at another network around the same time that I did. And so we were all not quite sure what to do next. But very fortunately, Max was able to get some independent support, basically say, look, I have these two people that are very talented and popular, and if we can get some funding, we would love to do something independent with The Gray Zone. And it was at this time, right when Trump recognized Juan Guaido, this alternative president in Venezuela, right, this phony regime that had no control over any ministries or the border, but they were putting him, they were recognizing him officially as the president. And we were all interested in Venezuela, having grown up in the U.S. with international left tendencies, seeing Chavez transform that country from afar. And so we decided, why don't we go to Venezuela? This is a hot story. Maybe if we go there, try to get some interviews and do some reports, this will be a good way to kickstart the Gray Zone as an independent media outlet, and so we went, and the rest is kind of history, because those videos ended up doing very well, and I ended up getting pretty involved in covering that, what I now call a corporate coup. I ended up writing a book, compiling some of my investigative reports on that coup operation, and showing how it was a template that can also be applied to Iran, of how the U.S. uses media tactics, diplomatic tactics, financial warfare, and dirty war tactics to stabilize its enemies. And I got really deep into the Venezuela case to show how they used this example of recognizing a phony government to basically steal billions of dollars worth of Venezuela's sovereign wealth, including gold that was stored in the Bank of England, or Citgo Petroleum, their subsidiary of their state oil company in the United States. It was all stolen and looted as a result of this policy. And so that kind of became my main area of interest, and the gray zone just took off from there.
Right, and you were like underground working from Venezuela.
I went there for a month the first time, and then I went back later that same year in 2019, because it was, at that time, Venezuela was chairing the non-aligned movement, and so diplomats from all over the world ended up convening in Caracas. Foreign Minister Zarif at the time was there. Lots of level officials, and so I went to cover that as well, because my interest in Venezuela then morphed into an interest into the changing world. As an American, I think it's important for us to understand how our sanctions policies and our weaponization of the dollar have actually blown back into our interest. And I was very fascinated by the way that the rest of the world was, instead of collapsing and giving up, rising to the occasion and coming together to fight against this financial empire, this dictatorship that is not serving us in the United States. It's not serving the people of Venezuela or Iran or really anyone in the world. So I just kind of kept chasing it from there. But in the end, I spent a total of about 3 months in Venezuela over different periods.
Right. And you did investigative journalism on the issue of the coup. Could we call it a failed coup now, or is it still going on?
It's definitely a failed coup in the sense that they never changed the regime, and now the Trump administration is even negotiating with Maduro, because they have to acknowledge that he's in charge. And
what is the other guy doing?
He's in Miami. I think he's a graduate student, and they actually now have had two more people replace him since. First, this figure who ran in the election last year, who they say won, and then he handed it over to Maria Corina Machado, who I write about in my book as one of the main U.S.-backed candidates since Chavez's time. Since the coup against Chavez in 2002, this woman has been receiving money from the United States, from NGOs and running NGOs to try to destabilize the country. She's now the president, according to the opposition, but the U.S., like I said, they've moved on. They're negotiating with Maduro, but it did succeed in the sense that, as I mentioned, billions of dollars worth of the country's wealth were stolen in broad daylight, and the recognition of this fake government just provided cover for that, because then they said all of your accounts in the U.S., all of your accounts in Europe are frozen. In fact, Maduro, just a few months before they recognized this government, had lodged a repatriation request with the Bank of England to bring back Venezuela's sovereign gold supply. So then conveniently Britain says, oh, we recognize this other guy, now we don't know who the president is, we have to keep this gold indefinitely. We get to steal it while we're having a gold shortage in London. That's convenient for them, right?
Same old, same old. And it's really funny how people are just influenced of this other guy was on top of all news, but then it died down, and nobody even asked where he is until now that we are talking about him. You said he's in Miami, he's a graduate, and, of course, living his life and the money of the people of Venezuela.
Off stolen money.
Of course. And what do you think was the element that made the Venezuelan government overcome this challenge?
They, like I'm sure you understand, in Iran, are in a very difficult situation, because when you have people living under sanctions for years, of course, some people are going to just change because they're concerned about their lives, and they want to live give the best possible standard of living to their families. But the history of Chavismo has done such a great job of getting to the roots and the poorest of society and lifting them up, that they've still held on to this solid base of support in the country. But it gets tricky as time goes on, as you know, because the pressure, people get tired and people become less political because they have to just worry about survival. But I do think that relationships such as the one that Venezuela built with Iran, for example, really did make a difference. I write about in the book how in 2019, 2020, Venezuela was facing a major oil crisis.
Yes.
Even though they had the oil, they have the largest oil supply in the world, their crude is very heavy. Yeah. It's thick, so it needs to be mixed with chemical inputs and light crude in order to be pumped. And they couldn't get access to the chemicals and the inputs that they needed at the time because they were cut off from the international market. They couldn't even make the payments that they used to make.
Right.
So you may recall it was in 2020, I believe, Iran sent 5 oil tankers. It was this big dramatic moment all the way from here to Venezuela in order to give them the equipment and the resources they needed to fix their crisis. The U.S. made a lot of threats. They sent a Navy ship, a major ship, to the Caribbean as a threat. But in the end, they couldn't go to war with Iran and Venezuela, so the ships arrived, and that actually broke their oil crisis. So this is an example of how the changing world, Americans may have never thought that Iran and Venezuela could look to each other for assistance, but that's not the only example. Turkey, other countries as well, Russia and China, these are the countries and the relationships that have made a difference in Venezuela's survival, and I think the survival of those countries as well. This is the world that is changing, that is emerging, where these countries can come together. They don't have to have the same ideology, the same economic system in their own countries, but they come to each other out of natural need to survive. I think in one of the interviews I did, the Venezuelan foreign minister at the time, Jorge Arreaza, said it's like the natural flow of a river. We all come together just because that's where nature has pushed us.
Yeah. And is that sort of a beginning, of course? I think we're in the middle of a beginning of a new world order.
I do think so. I know there are a lot of people who might jump, say, the U.S. empire is done, China and Russia have replaced it. I don't think we're there quite yet. The U.S. is still very strong.
Indeed.
But I do think that some of Trump's policies now reflect the sense that Americans know the world has changed and
they're realizing the fact
that they can't continue down this path anymore. The tariff war, for example, I think is a manifestation of that. It may have not been the wisest way of addressing this changing order, but it was a reaction. It was an anxiety that, the way that we're dealing with the world isn't going to serve us anymore. There's also been a lot of talk of anxiety about BRICS and the move away from the dollar. But again, that's just inevitable because we've sanctioned all these oil producers, Iran, Russia, Venezuela, and we're at a point when India, China, these are major consumers. We can't boss them around as the United States and tell them not to buy their oil. And so if we're not letting them trade in dollars, it's only natural that they're eventually going to trade their own currencies.
Of course. And of course, we have the hegemony of dollar, which is not that easy to be broken, of course. But this global south, the notion, what do you think of that? And how do you think it's going to end up?
I think that people are going to have higher standards of living in the future, and that I don't know how long it will take, but that we're all moving in the direction of a better life. I think even in the United States, as I said, while Trump's policy is very brutish, as an American, I do support the idea that we are less reliant on imports and that we actually focus on our own industry again, because that would be good for us.
Of course.
And so as I say, it's just the inevitable outcome of our abuse of the international system and the hegemony we've enjoyed for so long that has led to this. And I hope we can find our place in the new world as the United States, because I think the global South is going to get there anyway, whether we like it or not. We can't put the genie back in the bottle.
Right. And like you said, everything is moving towards a change. And the kind of change would be inevitable. We don't know if it's going to be tomorrow or a decade from now, but it's going to be eventually a multipolar world we're looking at. Thank you, Anya. It was a pleasure to talk to you here at SORP. I really wanted this conversation to go on, but we are at the end of the program. And thank you so much. This is the end of another SORP. But remember, SORP means only the beginning of the day. Until next time, it's goodbye from me, Bahman Roy.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints. The following